So I should thank the organizers first for putting together a nice conference, a nice workshop. This is the title that was assigned to me. So I'll try to say something about all of them. The numerical work, if I even make it to that, is done with Yaroslav Chekovniak and Yelena Finkler, both students at Harvard. Yaroslav is now a junior fellow. The work on Chern Simons' fermionic theory of the Pfaffian state was done with Nick Bonestell and Kerwin Foster. And a lot of the work on quantum computations was done with discussions with Nick Bonestell, also credit discussions with lots of other people. So for those of you who don't know what non-abelian statistics are and non-abelian states, I'll start with a very long introduction to bring everyone on board as to what all of this means. I'll talk about what the candidate quantum Hall states are, what the actual experimental status is. So this is pedagogical, this is status. Then we actually have some results and then some random musings about quantum computation and why this stuff is interesting and useful. So let's start with the pedagogical introduction, non-abelian statistics for beginners. So we can start with a dictionary. Non-abelian quantum Hall state is a quantum Hall state whose quasi-particle excitations are non-abelians. Underneath, it's always electrons, of course, making up your quantum Hall state. It's the quasi-particle excitations that have the interesting properties. So what's a non-abelian? It's a particle obeying non-abelian statistics, of course. So fermions obey fermionic statistics, bosons obey bosonic statistics, and non-abelians obey non-abelian statistics. So that leaves us with the obvious question, what is non-abelian statistics? Before defining this, I want to give a review of what we actually mean by statistics. So statistics is a statement about what happens to a many-particle wave function when you adiabatically exchange two identical particles. If you open up any quantum mechanics textbook, the dogma is that exchanging twice should get you back to the identity. You change once and you exchange again, you get back, the particles get back to their original configuration, and therefore you should get the identity. So you, in your quantum mechanics textbook, it says you can have bosons where you exchange once, you get the same wave function back, or you can have fermions where you get a minus sign, but then you do another exchange, you get two minus signs, that's one, and you're back to where you started with. The story is different in 2 plus 1 dimensions, because in 2 plus 1 dimensions, two exchanges is not equal to the identity. And to see this, you just plot world lines. So this is time in this direction, and this is space in this direction. Exchange the particles clockwise once, and then clockwise again, and you see that you left a braid in the world lines. And this is a very useful way to think. It's clear that this braided set of world lines is not topologically equivalent to the unbraided world lines. You can't deform these world lines into the unbraided world lines without cutting one of the world lines and crossing the other one through. So you can leave knots behind in your world lines here. In 3 plus 1 dimensions, two exchanges does equal the identity. The reason for that is that there's no such thing as knotting one-dimensional world lines in 3 plus 1 dimensions. If you imagine that this lived in a higher dimension, you could slip this string around the other without cutting it by using the additional dimension. So this is the statement that you can't tie your shoes in four dimensions is the same thing here. This has some rather profound effects on the statistics. In 3 plus 1 dimensions, you have no knots in the world lines. So if you think of some initial configuration and some final configuration, all the topologically different paths, all the sectors of the partition function, if you want, can be classified according to the different permutations of which particle started where and which particle ended where, or the different permutations, rearrangements of the particles. So the statistics you have are the different representations of the permutation group, which basically boils down to just having bosons or fermions or some combination of them. In 2 plus 1 dimensions, you can have knots in the world lines, and the topologically different paths are classified according to the different braids you can have getting from the initial configuration to the final configuration. So the statistics you can have are then some representation of the braid group, which is much richer than the representations of the permutation group. This gives you more possibilities, things like anions and non-abelians. So let's start with a simpler baby brother example of the anion. And what you have here is going from the initial to the final state. Your final wave function is given just by the initial wave function, I'm going to bring the particles back to the same initial configurations, times a phase, which is e to the I w times alpha. W here is the topological winding number of the braid. Alpha here is known as the statistical angle. If it's 0, you get bosons. If it's pi, you get fermions. But you can have any other value of alpha, and this you call anions, any other anion. Get it? That's the joke. I believe Wilczek is responsible for that nomenclature.
And he believes it should be pronounced anions, not anions. This is, historically, this has been a very important controversy.
In Murray Hill, New Jersey, it's called anions by decree. What's interesting about quantum Hall effect is the quasi-particle excitations of even simple fractional quantum Hall state really are anions, or at least it's believed to be true and has believed, and no one argues with this anymore. For a long time, people have known this. However, it's interesting to note, no one has ever measured this statement clearly. And that is going to be a rather challenge for us when we get to the Big Brother. Now, the Big Brother of fractional statistics is non-abelian statistics. This occurs when you have multiply degenerate ground states. So what I mean by this is suppose we have three identical quasi-particles and we fix their positions at R1, R2, and R3. Now, despite having fixed the positions at R1, R2, and R3, suppose there's a leftover degeneracy, say two orthogonal degenerate states, which we'll call psi1 and psi2. So the initial wave function we have can be any superposition of psi1 and psi2. So I'll write that as A1 times Psi1 plus A2 times Psi2. And just for my own perverse reasons, which will become convenient later, I'd like to write that as a vector representing the state of A1 and A2 here. Now we braid our particles around each other in some arbitrary way. And let's bring the particles back to the same three positions here, R1, R2, and R3. So again, since I'm in the same three positions, I have to have this some combination of these two states. However, it can be a different combination. So I'll write this as A1 twiddle and A2 twiddle. And again, I'll write that as a vector. Now, the transformation that takes me from the initial to the final wave function now is given by some unitary rotation, some unitary matrix, which takes my initial wave function into my final wave function. So what we have is a unitary matrix representing the particular braid operation I choose. And if I choose a different braid, I will get a different unitary matrix. So what we have is really a matrix representation of the braid group. And of course, since matrices don't commute with each other in general, the matrix representation can be non-abelian. What do I mean by non-abelian? Non-commutative. Everyone should probably know that word already. But what's important to realize is that the braid group is a non-abelian group. What I mean by this is if I have three quasi-particles here, and I switch the first two clockwise, and then the second two counterclockwise, for example, it's not the same as doing it in the opposite order of switching the second two counterclockwise followed by the first two clockwise. You can see that the resulting braids end up being topologically different objects. So what we have now is we can have our statistics being a matrix representation of the braid group being a non-abelian or non-commutative group. And matrices generally can be non-abelian, so we can have non-abelian, yes? I can turn it off, too, if that'll help. So we can have what we call non-abelian statistics. Now let's go back for a second to the case of anions, and why is it we don't have anything so interesting here? Remember here, what was important in getting from the initial to the final wave function was just the winding number. But the winding number is actually an abelian representation of the braid group. To see that, we see that this braid has winding number plus 1 from this part, winding number minus 1 from this part, whereas this giving us a total winding number of 0, whereas this braid has winding number minus 1 from this part and plus 1 from this part, giving us a winding number of 0. It doesn't matter. If you're just worried about the winding number, it doesn't matter what order you do the exchanges in. So winding number is an abelian representation of the braid group, so fractional statistics are abelian. But in general, you can have non-abelian matrix representations. So to review again, for non-abelian statistics, what you have is a vector representing the state within some degenerate space. So there's a bunch of degenerate eigenstates all representing the quasi-particles in the same positions. And the initial wave function is some linear superposition of those, which we write as a vector. Some unitary matrix represents any adiabatic braining operation. It's also known as a Berry's matrix that takes you from initial to your final matrix, depending on what braid you choose to do. There's one additional point with some very minor additional assumptions. The degenerate space, or the size of this vector, is typically exponentially large in the number of particles you have. There's a cartoon picture of the non-abelian states which is useful to keep in your mind. So imagine, again, I have my three particles at my three positions here. And just in your mind, imagine that there are some spin degrees of freedom attached to these particles, such that the energy of the state is absolutely independent of what the configuration of those spins are. So obviously there we would have a degenerate state whose size is 2 to the n, just corresponding to the n degrees of freedom and two states for each possible degree of freedom. Now, we braid the particles around each other, and the action of braiding flips over those spins. What's interesting is that you get rotation in this spin space only from doing braiding. There's nothing else that can come in and flip over these spins. This is really interesting. You know, you can't have phonons come in and flip over these spins. You can't have photons come in and flip over these spins. And that makes you realize immediately that this is going to be very interesting for quantum information and quantum computation. The reason being, this is very robust and topologically robust. It's very hard to make these spins flip over unintentionally. So it's rather immune from decoherence in this sense. So Kitaev and Freeman and a bunch of other people have been thinking about this for a number of years, and I'll come back to this topic a lot later in the talk.
Why is one spin flipped and the other one
not? Oh, this is just some. This is. I didn't. This is just sort of a generic, you know, picture. It could be anything. I'll come back to something more honest later. Complications. First of all, typically you only have one degree of freedom per m particles, with m greater than one. So these spin degrees of freedom are sort of delocalized objects which are not associated with a single quasiparticle. And in fact, that's in some sense what protects them from decoherence, that it's not a local object that you can hit with a local phonon and flip over. It's hard to identify exactly what these degrees of freedom are. What do I mean by that? Well, let me show you the one case that's understood very well. The one case that's understood very well is the Moore-Reed-Fafian state, which is essentially the same as a chiral p-wave two-dimensional superconductor. In this case, each quasiparticle, or in the superconductor, each vortex, has one Majorana fermion attached to it, or half of a real fermion. So we put a bunch of quasiparticles in a plane, and each one having a Majorana means that if you group them together in groups of two, so let's make an arbitrary grouping, each group of two has a degree of freedom. That fermion can be either filled or empty, or you can think of that as being a spin up or a spin down. So it's a rather unlocal object. So the dimension of this space is 2 to the number of quasiparticles divided by 2, because each two quasiparticles gives you one fermionic degree of freedom that can be either occupied or unoccupied. You can imagine braiding some of these particles around each other in some way. When you get back to the original state here, in this case, this is true, you will flip each of the spins associated with the pairing that I've chosen. What's interesting is I could have chosen a different pairing here, and that corresponds to working in a different basis. So I could have paired this guy with this guy and this guy with this guy. You get exactly the same results, except it's in a different basis. This is the best understood case. There are other cases which are much less well understood. In this case, wrapping just makes a pi rotation. Can it compute? This is a very important question. Yes?
So this is best understood because we know what the wave function is and so on?
I mean, no. Knowing what the wave function is doesn't really, well, it does help you some. But it's understood, I would say, there's a couple of approaches for the Fafian which are understood. People can study the wave function directly. They can study the conformal field theory, which I'll talk about later. But I think most important is that for the Moore-Reed-Fafian, you can make a mapping to BCS paired composite fermions, and that really helps you out in understanding what's going on.
My point is that they're not really strictly degenerate.
I'll come back to that issue at the end of the talk. Yeah, if they're sufficiently well separated, they become close to. Right, right, right. I'll come back to that later in the talk, because obviously having the exact degeneracy is important for quantum computation up to some degree. So, yeah.
But here you're talking about the ideal Hoolrich state, where one has a degeneracy.
Yes, yeah. So, can it compute? It turns out universal quantum computation is basically the same statement as saying you can approximate any unitary transformation you want. The Moore-Reed-Fofian cannot do this. And the reason is that in some language, the braid group representation is not dense. So let's think about U1 for a second. If I can do universal quantum computation in U1, that means I should be able to get to any angle possible by doing enough of my elementary operations. However, for Moore-Reed, what you have is something that looks more like this. You have a couple operations you can do, but very soon you begin to repeat yourself, and you don't fill out all of space, so you can't get to all possible rotations using the Moore-Reed state.
But how large is that public space that you live in?
That you live in?
And how does that scale with n?
Well, the Hilbert space is always exponential in n.
No, I know, but is this closed?
This closed subsector is also exponential in n.
Who cares?
I don't think that's good enough for quantum computation. Exponentially big is not good enough. You have to be able to make any unitary operation.
You're talking about the size of the space of operators, somehow it's different from the space of states, isn't it?
Let's
try and make it
space. There's states.
Okay, so there's some group of unitary operations that's generated by some set of basic operations that are allowed by these states, right? But then the number of states is a question of what representation of that group.
Okay.
Are there different questions?
Well, what's important is the number of states, no? I mean, I know, but if you can move anywhere in that space, and it's a huge... If dimensionality of Hilbert space is exponentially large in the number of quasi particles, then you can do any unitary operation.
That statement means that you can't go from an arbitrary state in that Hilbert space to another arbitrary state.
But you can go from one to how many others? I mean, it sort of breaks into subspaces, right?
But that's not good enough, you need to be able to go to all.
I don't understand. If the subspace is itself exponentially large, I mean, what if it just broke into two sectors?
For example, you can't construct a controlled knot. I mean, some of these basic things you want to do, you can't even do a controlled knot in this subspace. Even though you have an exponentially large space, you can't. You don't have enough freedom to. We can sit down and work through it.
I guess it can be simplified tremendously if you just define what is your qubit. I mean, once you have a qubit, then you can describe the space.
Let me come back to that also, because there are different options of how you construct a qubit. For the Moore-Reed-Fofian, you can't construct a qubit at all, because you want the minimum thing you probably want to be able to do is do arbitrary SU2 rotations on that qubit. You can't even do that for the Fofian. So even if you have a one qubit quantum computer, the Fofian isn't good enough. Why this happens? It's the commutation of Majorana fermions that you always end up getting, basically 90-degree rotations in some space. I'm not sure it's because they're real, but you square them, you get one. You're always going to get 90.
The reason you get 90-degree rotations because the quasi particle has to come back to exactly the same point, and then you examine the phase that accumulates. I don't think they're understanding if you allow the quasi particle go from a finite set of configurations and what happened in between. So my understanding, the fact that these are discrete is because you start with this three and come back with exactly three.
Well, you're going to want to do that, because you certainly want to be able to interfere some initial configuration with some final configuration. But it's, I mean, it's the commutation of Majoranas that does it to you. I mean, the anti-commutation and the, I mean, there's very little you can get with those commutation rules is the problem.
That means sort of all representations are finite dimensional, or something like that. That would be the right way to say it. Even get the number of.
No, the statement is that you cannot get all operators, all unitary operators. You cannot approximate them by some number of these rate operations. There are some that you cannot approximate. That's the problem. So there's some computations which you just cannot do.
But why are we defining computations as the requirement that we can move anywhere in this Hilbert space? You know, that's why I guess that's what I'm confused.
Eric, you need some other operators that shake up things, and you think
I mean, there's another question is maybe what computations can you do if you say, you know, you can't get to the whole Hilbert space, you can only get to the partial Hilbert space. Yeah. I don't know the answer to that question offhand, but we can sit down.
Does the size of the partial Hilbert space grow with the number of quasi-particles?
It does, but if you start looking at one single quasi-part, you know, a very small subset of the space, and you say, what can I get to in there? It's you get to a finite set, which is always, you know, it goes exponentially, but ends up being a finite set. So let me head on because
that's completely has to do with what one means by universal computation.
Right.
How you define the outer
subsets. Right. Right. Yes.
Whole thing depends on whether you have qubits. Peter can speak. Peter, if I don't have qubit, then it doesn't make sense to talk about computations. But the current scheme of computation depends on.
I'll show you the options.
Maybe new paradigms. That's issue. Yeah.
I'll show you the options for how you construct a qubit in a bit. That will come up later. So. So anyway, I give this a sad face at any rate because you're not getting a dense representation. The simplest state that quantum computes by the definition of being able to reach any state in some space is known as the K=3 Parafermionak-Reed-Rezai state, which is a big brother of the Moore-Reed-Fafian. So the Moore-Reed-Fafian is also known as the K=2 parafermion state. So we're going to compare it to the K=3. The Moore-Reed-Fafian is the exact ground state of a short-range three-body interaction. And it's a short-range repulsive three-body interaction. So that immediately tells you that it's going to involve pairing of electrons. Why is that? Well, it costs you nothing to put two particles on top of each other, but it costs you something to put a third on. So you'll freely put the two on top of each other and then make the pairs stay as far apart from each other as possible. The K=3 parafermion state is just one greater. There's a short-range four-body interaction, so it involves three electron clusters. It costs you nothing to put three particles on top of each other, but then costs you to put the fourth on. So you'll make three electron clusters and keep the clusters away from each other. For the Moore-Reed-Fafian, you get a Majorana on each quasiparticle. So the Hilbert space is 2 to the number of quasiparticles over 2. Now, in this case, the story is much more complicated. What it looks like you're getting is a Z3 parafermion in each quasiparticle. I'm not going to define.
What's the purpose of this? What message I'm trying to convey? I don't understand.
The message I'm conveying is that Moore-Reed and K=3 parafermion are related states, but this is sort of the big brother of that. But I'm about to tell you that life is horrible. Z3 parafermion is, you know, you require three of those to make an electron.
So I should get out that one Hilbert space bigger than the other ones.
Yeah, this Hilbert space is bigger than this one, but it doesn't go in a nice way. It goes as a, you know, n quasiparticle minus 2 Fibonacci number. So this immediately tells you there's going to be a lot of problems. One problem is that in this case, I could say, let's take two quasiparticles, and in some basis, you group them together, and one degree of freedom is associated with those two quasiparticles. Over here, your life is much worse, because you can't even sit down and say, let's isolate some set of, say, three quasiparticles and call them one degree of freedom and see what's going on there. So it's immediately telling you that things are going to be a lot more complicated.
The reason we wanted to have this qubit interpretation is because we want to use Shor's algorithm.
For example, yes.
But it's conceivable that if you don't, then there's, you know, other algorithms.
There may be other algorithms that you can.
Yes. Absolutely. We commit to kind of whether we want to commit to the current scheme of computation. But I agree with you. We don't need to commit to it in case we are new things wanted to think of.
Yeah.
I wonder whether this one has a similar kind of splitting of the degenerate levels in the quasi particles or not.
It's suspected, but I don't think it's really known. I think it's suspected, but not known.
This particular wave function.
Yeah.
Well, this state, if we perturb this exact Hamiltonian.
Yeah. Actually, I think numerically it is probably.
Wave function.
Yeah.
Is
But that's a generic property of these phases, even when these particles are close?
No. When they get close, you break the degeneracy, typically. That I believe is true. I mean, there's no analytic calculation that I know of that shows you that for these Big Brothers, the parafermionic states. But I believe numerically that's known. You'd suspect it. You'd be very surprised if it weren't the case.
I mean, because quasi-particles have some residual interaction, size.
Yeah. So anyway, this is going to be some horrible thing that's even worse than non-locality here. So that one's making our life more difficult. So I'm going to make a short detour into conformal field theory.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
Since we're really talking about the deep issues of quantum computation, I think there is a very important issue of measurements. Now, I think
I'll come back and talk about measurement in a moment.
Oh.
Yeah. So I've thought about this for all of one day. I've thought of the obvious things at any rate. So I'm not going to explain this approach in detail, but it's worth remembering how non-abelians were discovered. And this was from Warren Reed. The wave functions for various quantum Hall states can be written down as correlators of conformal field theory. For example, the Laughlin wave function, just written like this, you can get by defining conformal field theory with the usual free correlator, and then writing it as such. This is a rather perverse way of writing the Laughlin wave function, but it's advantageous because you can then write down more complicated conformal field theory to generate a whole set of wave functions and talk about their properties without even necessarily being able to calculate in detail what the wave function looks like. So in fact, that was how Moore and Reed cooked up the Pfaffian state to begin with. Moreover, you can demonstrate the degeneracy of the multi-quasi-particle state by counting the conformal blocks of the conformal field theory. Now, the degeneracy of the multi-quasi-particle states is really the critical thing that you need in order to have non-abelian statistics. You have to have this massive degeneracy. One more thing you can do is you can almost calculate braiding behavior. In other words, what happens when you take one quasi-particle around another. Now, I have the word almost in here for two reasons. Reason one is because you have to be very good at conformal field theory and quantum groups and so forth, things that are beyond my ability to do, although, you know, once they've been done by someone else who's much smarter, you can sort of figure out what it is they've done. But that's not the serious issue. The serious issue is that there's a missing link. So what we have is we have quantum Hall wave functions that we've written as correlator of a conformal field theory, and then conformal blocks counting the degeneracy. Now, conformal field theories are also closely related to knots and braiding and things like that via work done by Witten in 1989. If you ever wondered why Witten won the Fields Medal, it was actually this connection between Chern-Simons theory, conformal field theories, and knot theories that got him the Fields Medal. But there's a missing link between these two, which is the statement that the quasi-Hall statistics are given by the braiding properties of conformal field theory is still a conjecture. It's a good conjecture, and you can say it based on, you know, what else could the answer be? But in fact, it's not been proven. There's sort of a missing statement having to do with the orthogonality of, in some sense, of the conformal blocks, which is not been proven and sort of still lurking out there in the field. So research.
Do you question it? I mean, you personally don't question it.
Actually, I don't really know for sure. I suspect it's right because everything seems to come out in a way that you would like. But the only case that we really have independent check on is the Pfaffian. And the Pfaffian, we already know, is kind of a special case. So, I think I would be a little surprised if it came out different, but yeah. Anyway, what we would like to do is show some sort of numerical evidence of this conjecture to find this missing link. So that's one main research direction. This is numerical work that I'll talk about if I get to it. So if you assume the missing link, the k equals 3 parafermionic Reed-Rezai state is related to the SU2 at level k Kern-Simons theory, and a theorem by Friedman tells you that this is sufficient to quantum compute by the definition that you can reach any state in this Hilbert space, any rotation in this Hilbert space, unless k equals 1, 2, and 4. So k equals 3 is good enough. But 2, which is the case of the Fafian, is not good enough. 4 is, actually, you can show yourself that 4 turns out to be, in the sense that the Fafian is a 90-degree rotation, 4 is a 30-degree rotation, and it closes on itself very quickly. So, and there's one other special case, which is, I forget which one it is, 6, which it turns out that you can do universal quantum computation, but it's somehow not as good as the others because you can't quite reach as many as you would want to or something like that, but I'm not going to go into that.
Oh, is there a quantum Hall analog for the 6?
Yeah, all of these have quantum Hall analogs. Okay, okay, okay. And they all...
What fraction would that... What factor would that be?
Got it. So... I don't know.
Well, that's a different question. Okay. The question of whether it actually occurs in a quantum... real quantum Hall system is a different question from whether it's a theoretical quantum Hall analog. I mean, the answer is yes, they're a theoretical system.
Theoretically, you can always make these states with n-body interactions. So the SE2 at level... so this k equals 3 is a 4-body interaction. 5 would be a 6... six-body interaction, and so forth and so on. So, yeah.
Can you explain this theorem a little bit more? I mean, can quantum compute, this is independent of Schur algorithm or anything. It just one can construct control not, I guess. That's the sense in
That would be sufficient to, that would be sufficient, that would be a constructive proof of being able to quantum compute. If you can do single qubit operations and control not, that's sufficient.
Control?
No, that's not how he did it,
okay.
No.
Because I don't understand
the operation means what exactly?
The what?
Which operations on a single qubit is quantum?
You need, there's a set of operations on a single qubit you have to be able to do. Like if you can do, there's a whole, you have a choice, a menu. Like if you choose a Hadamard and a
the
controlled
phase. The menu is designed such that for a given fixed number of qubits, I can, by a sequence of these, get arbitrarily close to,
right,
to any unit.
And the truth is that if you sort of pick a set of random operations, they're almost always good enough.
And
that,
Schur's algorithm does this? I mean, it uses this property, for instance?
That you, so how strict is Schur's algorithm? I don't know.
Does Schur's algorithm require this?
I suspect it, my suspicion is it does, that you basically need to have all
and,
of these.
And the converse, when something doesn't satisfy it, it means if I have a fixed set of quasi-particles here, the group of unitary transformations that I can construct is finite.
It's finite, exactly. Yeah. So it basically, you're going to close on top of yourself very quickly. Yeah. Okay. So that's the pedagogical introduction. Half an hour. Let's move on to what the candidate states are. So these are the main sets of states, the 5-halves and 7-halves states, which are thought to be the Moore-Reed-Fafian state, which, as I mentioned before, is also a BCS, can think of this as a BCS chiral P-wave paired composite fermion state. The more interesting one is the 12-fifths and 13-fifths, which would be the k equals 3 Reed-Rezai parafermionic state, if they're there. These states are thought to have non-abelian quasiparticle excitation. So where are they?
Yeah,
this is a 17 million mobility sample. It's one that Lauren Pfeiffer jokingly calls his low mobility sample. You got to remember that the mean free path of at 17 million is like 100 microns or something like that. So this is down at 4 millikelvin, and you see the 5-half state very nicely formed. And you see 12-fifths and 13-fifths, it's particle-hole conjugate, which would be the k equals 3 Reed-Rezai, which might be the k equals 3 Reed-Rezai state.
Be careful there. Might is the word.
There's a might. Let me come back to that, because I have that in two or three overheads. There's 5-halves and 7-halves in a higher mobility sample at 15 millikelvin, but you notice that the 12-fifths and 13-fifths are completely absent in these pictures, despite the higher mobility. But if you cool it down to 9 millikelvin, there's 5-halves is there, beautiful. 12-fifths does arise, although 13-fifths seems to be conspicuously absent. So it seems possible they're here, but it's at the very least, it needs to be very cold and very clean. The numerical evidence So five halves and seven halves are, this is sort of perturbation around pure Coulomb interaction. The X is pure Coulomb interaction. And you know, you're sort of just over the phase boundary into a stripe state, but by just using a little bit of finite well width or slight perturbation of the Coulomb interaction, you can move into the regime of paired states. So these are the two candidates that numerically seem to be possible near five halves or seven halves. And the fact that we see good quantization is very good evidence that it has to be the Mohr Reed state, because we don't really have any other candidates that could be sitting there. For 12-fifths and 13-fifths, the story is a little more complicated, because there's another quantized Hall state that could possibly occur there, which is the 3-fifths state of the usual hierarchy. And even though in this set of data, which was published by Reed and Rezai for 15 electrons, right near the Coulomb point, that's at zero, the parafermion state seems to have a very high overlap with the exact ground state, and the hierarchy state seems to have a very poor overlap. According to Ed, when you go to larger systems, it's not really as clear that parafermion wins over hierarchy. So it is sort of an open question. So these are the two quantum Hall candidates. There've been discussion of a number of other states that could have these properties also. I'm not going to say anything about them. But also there's been the people who are talking about rotating Bose condensates. We heard about this yesterday from Sandy Fetter, I guess, by Cooper, Wilkin, and Gunn. Is Gunn here? Is it? There you are, yes. Okay, good. Have been talking about this for a while. I stole this overhead from Nigel Cooper. For those of you who haven't seen this, the Hamiltonian for your Bose condensates is basically free bosons, a trap over here, and then short-range repulsive interactions, which in fact you can even tune the interaction coefficient there. You put it in a rotating frame, get the whole thing rotating, and you end up with what looks like a vector potential or a magnetic field, rotation taking the place in the magnetic field. You also get the confinement. The centrifugal force basically gives you the confinement in plane, out of plane being much stronger than the confinement in plane, so it becomes two-dimensional. So what you get is a mapping to a bosonic quantum Hall system, and a lot of the same physics goes through exactly. The theoretical status for rotating bosons, there's a nice result by Nigel Cooper that if you tune to a Feshbach resonant, you get exactly the Bose analog of the Mohr-Reed Pfaffian, exact statement in some limit. From exact diagonalizations, we believe an entire set of Reed-Rezai non-abelian parafermionic states occur at filling fractions k over 2. These gives you the ZK parafermionic theory, so 2 is the Mohr-Reed state, 3 is the k equals 3 parafermionic state, and you can go all the way up to roughly 12, something like that. All of these have non-abelian statistics thought to occur. However, there's a caveat. It's hard to extract convincing information from exact diagonalizations for both systems, for small systems, because as compared to for electrons, the Hilbert space is much larger. So you're stuck doing much smaller systems than you'd like, and it's not completely clear how they extrapolate for larger systems. So even though this data from this paper was very, very suggestive, it's something that I've heard countering viewpoints from other people who did exact diagonalizations more recently. So could go either way. So I was going to talk about numerical experiments, but since at the last minute, and I think it was a good choice, I thought the question is, what happens when you braid quasiparticles around each other? If I don't get to it, I'll tell you in one word, we do Monte Carlo to actually do this as a simulation in some sense. And at least for the Pfaffian, it does indeed agree with what everyone expected in the first place, and the parafermionic states is something we're still working on. So let me skip that, though. Let's do that. Give that as a summary, and go on to musings about quantum computation. So I always get annoyed when people muse too much about things that they really haven't progressed on that much. But I think I do have a couple things to say, and I'll try to be honest about them. I always wondered what he was thinking about. Now you know. Typically, quantum computation. He's not thinking about where he left his clothes.
That's what we're thinking about.
Yeah, yeah. Quantum computation using these non-abelian states is typically called topological quantum computation. So for those of you who I've never heard the words. That's what it means. So these are some of the issues. One is, how do you represent qubits? How do you initialize the qubits? How do you do the computation, which obviously is going to involve braiding? How do you read out your result? And what kind of decoherence processes do you have? In some sense, this is an engineering problem. There are trade-offs. There are many ways to do this. There are many options. There's options of how you represent a qubit, options of how you do the braiding, options of how you read out how you initialize, and, well, there's no options on decoherence. But how you choose to do these things will greatly affect how you analyze the problem and the result that comes out. So if people actually are going to build these sort of topological quantum computers someday, it's going to be a big engineering problem, and you're going to have to weigh certain problems against certain advantages. So there's no unique answer to many of these questions. So one, representing qubits.
There are good and bad answers.
Well, good and bad depend on exactly what's your problem. You know, what is easy for you to do and what is hard for you to do. For example, something that might be easy for you to do in a rotating Bose condensate might be very hard in your usual quantum Hall state, just because
but rotating Bose condensates have not reached quantum Hall regime.
So we have some faith, you know. So, okay. So for k equals 3 Reader's-Eye parafermionic state, the Hilbert space, as I mentioned, grows as Fibonacci numbers, which in a large n limit goes as 2 plus square root of 5 to the number of quasiparticles over 3. And you immediately see that this is less than 2 to the number of quasiparticles. So you're going to need at least 2 quasiparticles to make a qubit. But for example, you could represent 2 qubits with 3 quasiparticles. This is your option of how you would like to do things. And there are advantages and disadvantages to choosing to use more or fewer qubits. For example, 2 quasiparticles can make a qubit, but it turns out that you can't move around such a qubit easily. It turns out it's enough to do to be able to do exchange nearest neighbor exchanges. You know, if you can take this qubit and switch it with its neighbor, you can always move a qubit over to somewhere else where you need to do some 2 qubit operation and then move it back. So being able to do a nearest neighbor operation that exchanges it is good enough to enable you to do universal quantum computation. But it's something that you would maybe like to be able to do, be able to take a qubit from over here and move it very easily to some qubit over here, do a 2-qubit operation, and then move it back without having to do successive exchanges in a very complicated way to neighbor by neighbor. Furthermore, 2 quasiparticles is rather makes life difficult because the braid group on 2 particles is rather trivial. It's just the integers. You know, you can only go left or go right, and that's it.
I understand a very simple question. I'm just focused on one single qubit. I want to construct a state which alpha up plus beta down. I need to have a superposition of 2 states.
Right.
How am I going to construct such a state with the quasiparticles?
If I don't answer it within about 5 overheads, ask me again. Okay. You probably will ask me again, but at least I've kept you at bay for 5 overheads. So so what you're going to have to do, since the braid group on 2 particles is trivial, you obviously can't get to any point in, if I just want to do SU2 rotations on 1 qubit, I can't do any one, but just braiding 2 particles around each other, it's just not big enough. So I'm going to have to borrow another quasiparticle from another qubit to move it over, do some operation, try to make sure that quasiparticle is somehow put back in its original state, and then bring it back. With 3 or 4 quasiparticle representations of a qubit, you can arrange such that the 4 quasiparticles look like the quasiparticle vacuum. This is sort of an important principle, that you can take a bunch of quasiparticles and put them in a state such that they have the quantum numbers of the vacuum, and do operations on the inside of that group of particles. And so among those quasiparticles, things are getting entangled. But to outsiders, they still look like the vacuum. If you do such a thing, you can take that group of quasiparticles, move it freely around all your other quasiparticles without worrying how it braided around them, bring it up close to some other guy, braid it up with that other guy, and then move it back.
It just seems like this software is, you know, largely incompatible with the hardware.
Just using
this qubit motif, if you will. I mean, you're sort of forcing this to use that software.
Yeah.
Whereas, Isn't not inconceivable that it's just completely different.
There's a better way to get there.
It's much better algorithm, much more suited to this.
Yeah, I think this is an open question in quantum computation in general.
Yeah.
That people like to reduce things down to qubits because then it's easy to think about. Because when you're trying to build up some very complicated, you know, if someone hands you, a 1,000-dimensional unitary operation and says construct it, you may find a much easier way to do it than breaking it down into lots of small qubits. But as the problem gets exponentially and exponentially harder, the process of finding that is going to get very difficult unless you can break it down.
Well, although there's maybe a natural one that might emerge if one understood these things well enough.
Yeah, no, I agree.
Maybe.
I agree. And at this level, you know, instead of using qubits, a lot of people say, look, you know, if it's just a matter of, instead of working with things with two states, work with things with 20 states or something like that. And yeah, you're going to have to do a lot of computation up front to figure out how to manipulate those 20 states. But once you've done that, have it in some library, you may be able to make a lot of shortcuts over what other algorithms would allow you to do.
I think it's really our dream, and you know, everybody. I think if one day quantum computation becomes very useful, I think probably there will be a breakthrough, that there will be even a new paradigm of computation, and maybe a combination of some of this remarkable thing with a new kind of algorithm. But I agree with you, it is conceivable, and it's something one should look at, but as of now, unfortunately, we all have only one workable scheme that we know of, which is in Nielsen and Chung, Merman's notes, etc. But that's what we have to work with at the moment as well.
I know, but that's because the only thing people have thought.
No, I agree with you.
I think one of the reasons people perhaps aren't motivated to look for these things is typically because improving in this way only is going to help you polynomially. A lot of these, the fact that you got Shor's algorithm gave you an exponential speed up to begin with, and improving over that, you may not care so much. If you're actually building one, it's like Bill Gates said, the real money is going from n cubed to n squared, polynomial speed up is if you're actually building something actually means something. But from a fundamental standpoint, it's the exponential speed up you're looking for.
Sure, that's a simple principle.
Yeah.
We already have that.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I mean, you're trying to be more practical.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
And as far as searching for algorithms goes, the status is, I understand,
there are
three algorithms.
Shor's is really the only one. Shor's and error, both from Shor. Shor's algorithm and error correction.
So
some people say Grover's algorithm
prospects
is
for really new algorithms, maybe even more difficult than getting.
Yeah, it's quantum computation, as far as anyone knows, really the truth is it's just for spying on your neighbors. It's only factoring that people are concerned about. Nothing else is really. Gotten
not,
it.
Not
yeah.
For lack of effort.
Yeah, no, sure people.
The algorithm is how old now?
So. 10 years, yeah. So.
Amazing. The scarcity of new.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, no, it
indicates it's a great damn problem.
You're
right that maybe.
Just a paradigm. Before the digital computers, there were analog computers. Like you could put together all those components to do some mathematical problem solving.
Yep.
Because you knew that those components could do this particular thing that you could solve differential equations with.
Yeah.
So there's no thinking about possible phases again. You can take the possible systems in which you can do quantum computations that are not necessarily represented as qubits, but they might do something else very quickly, the same way that op-amps can differentiate, but not being
It's possible.
There
are thoughts on what else can you do if you have some quantum hardware, and people are trying to come up with other uses for small quantum hardware things some of these besides cryptography and things like that you can do with small quantities of quantum hardware to try to push us along push the field along in the same direction. But
there hasn't been anything interesting along that line. Still,
some people will argue that some of the the quantum verification algorithms are cryptographic algorithms are of interest.
RSA is so good for cryptography. So yes. This one has a quantum computer.
Until you have a quantum computer, yeah.
I mean,
so.
No motivation to do that. I mean,
yeah.
At least in the United States, there's not even any funding.
Well, you know, the, if you...
Who cares?
It must be uninteresting then.
No, who cares? No, no, no. The thing is that 10 years apart, that's the crucial thing. And mathematicians have not come up with anything. That's, you know, that's non-trivial and substantive. I mean, these are all very small things, what all these other usage.
Well, I mean, one of the things that... you know, one has to remember is that many very smart mathematicians are of the belief that it is hard to factor large numbers. But there's no proof of that.
Of course not. Yeah.
And, you know, someone comes along and, you know, discovers some way to factor large numbers.
That's it.
You know, then you need quantum cryptography. Not that I suspect it's going to happen.
Where's alpha up plus beta down?
Let me get there. So. The other thing, with three or four quasi-particle representations of a qubit, you can do, you know, braiding of three and four quasi-particles is a very non-trivial group already, and you can easily fill out SU2 with just three or four quasi-particles in a qubit. So initializing. I think the way one has to think about initializing is to use the statement that local operations should be undetectable far away unless you're already entangled with faraway quasiparticles. So you can always create states locally that have the same quantum numbers as a quasiparticle vacuum and go from there. So those are always going to be somehow your initial states. So something like an adiabatic flux insertion, a Laughlin creation of hot quasi-holes, will create three quasiparticles with quantum numbers which are the same as the vacuum. Do this somewhere and then you start entangling them in some known way. Similarly, you can pull a quasi-particle, quasi-hole pair from the quasi-particle vacuum. These will have the same quantum numbers as the vacuum. Then you start entangling them to change their quantum numbers. Another thing that's been proposed is if you're very good at measuring your state, you can generate random qubits locally until you find one that's in the initial state you like. Well, OK, again, one has to ask, what is it you're going to be good at and what is it you're not going to be good at? Computation. So let me come to this. So this is what a qubit's going to look like, OK? It will have some set of quasi-particles, qubit 1, qubit 2. An operation on qubit 2 will look like something like this. It will make this is a known rotation that you can calculate in qubit 2 space. And a two-qubit gate, like a controlled knot, could look like this, for example. Now, the truth
is all operating on the computational basis, either one, zero. Each one of them is not a superposition of anything.
Now, each one of these can be put in a superposition of a 1-0 state, and
I want to see that. That's all. That is what I want to see.
Okay, so start with one that's in a zero state.
Yeah.
Do an SU2 rotation on it. Now it's in a superposition. You know, the oops.
What operation again?
Let's see. Thing just died. Hang on. There we go. So if I started this in a pure state, say a zero state, mm-hmm. I make this operation on it, it's now in a superposition.
You can do any SU2 rotation?
You can do with three quasiparticles you can do any SU2.
With enough order.
But the problem it may be a lot if you want to get very close this is same with controlled knot. It may take many braid operations to approximate even something simple like a single qubit rotation or a CNOT gate. And
No, Steve, I thought you said that by just doing that operation, you only gain a bare space for that triplet of quasi-particles. You do not get a superposition, right?
No, you get a superposition. Okay. There's a degenerate ground state. These things have a degenerate ground state.
That's crucial.
Yeah. I mean, theoretically, rotating one state to another one, right?
So
a superposition?
Yeah, so what you get is going to be a superposition of the original degenerate state. That's crucial here, having the degenerate. That's the important thing here.
So
the whole thing is based on the degeneracy.
There's an important theorem by Kateyev and Solovey.
Everything's a pure state.
In some basis.
Exactly.
In my favorite basis, though, it's you can entangle it. That assures us that it only gets log harder to approximate the answer more closely. This said, the prefactor of that log can be really nasty. So it may take you, say, 1,000 braids to get your controlled knot within some, log of 1,000 or something like that.
Hold on. I thought that these operations have been worked out. Again, by great minds like Kateyev and Michael Friedman and so on. I mean, why are you saying me? I mean, it's not known or not known?
It's known. These things are not worked out by Kateyev and company, but they are worked out by some people. That actually, I'm not even sure that they've been worked out. The problem is that this assures you how to do it. It doesn't give you a unique prescription. It gives you several prescriptions, and those haven't been compared or anything like that. I mean, all these things can be. It's again, it becomes an engineering problem, and it depends on how you represent your qubit in the first place, and so it's a messy problem. Computation by braiding. There's no escaping the need to move quasiparticles around in complicated ways. This should be, I suppose, obvious. Perhaps, I mean, I don't know so much about rotating Bose gases, and I know even less about what atomic physicists can do, but it seems to me that atomic physicists are pretty much able to do anything you ask them, although they haven't been able to do the rotating Bose gas yet. But other than that, they seem to have a lot of hammers that they wield. And so it's perhaps easier, you could imagine, taking a bunch of laser beams in to create quasiparticles and moving them around in some known way. Could be easier.
But hold on, I mean, I know very little about rotating Bose gases. But first, they have to have quasiparticles to move around. I mean, what you're talking about moving are not quasiparticles.
You're going to have to.
No, it's real atoms.
No. You go in with a laser beam to create a quasiparticle, make a little potential, create a quasiparticle, and then move it around. You make a little trap for,
And we don't really know how easy or how difficult those things would be for
they can take, I mean, Kennedy's done some experiments several years ago where they took a big flat bottom potential and then a narrow laser beam, and you could pull a local perturbation down to make it much more dense. And you could then, by shifting this laser beam around, you could control where the hole, where this deformation is.
Yeah.
Can we move vortices around? Haven't been able to do that, though. Because that would be kind of the...
No.
Somewhere
analog.
Not yet.
To
try? In principle, you should be able to do that because it couples the core. So in principle, one should be able to do that. The problem is the limit they're in now is the cores are some
the quasi part
there's some micron size.
The vortices become the quasi part.
It's a density. I mean, it's a density perturbation. Coupled to the particle density.
Yeah, but the density in the core varies too.
But that's how you imagine doing it in like quantum Hall effect. When you imagine making some potential that couples to
the density.
I'm just saying as a test, the vortex core, the density is different inside the core, and so you get a density.
Yeah, I think actually,
can you move a vortex around?
That's some people actually controlling a local density. These sort of schemes. I mean, Peter Zola, who's sitting over there, construct the scheme for making and manipulating quasi particles around in a fractional state.
So yeah.
People have thought about it.
Peter, raise your hand.
Peter? It's actually pretty hard to do these things, but nothing is possible.
Yeah. Well, the creativity of atomic physicists has been rather impressive over the last couple of years. So we can set our hopes on that. With quantum Hall, I know more about it, and it's really at the edge of what is conceivable. Not necessarily impossible, but certainly difficult.
What edge are you talking about?
But then you can ask yourself, how much more insane is this than other quantum computation proposals? And someone once said that any idiot with this two-state system thinks they have a quantum computer. And to a first approximation, that's actually more or less right. It really isn't that much more insane than a lot of other proposals that have been taken seriously. Some of the other proposals are actually quite good also, but this one does have some notable advantages. One thing to note is actually you can work with blobs of quasiparticles so long as you can move them around without dropping any. And from an engineering standpoint, if you have a chunk of quasiparticles which has 10 of them, and it's easier to grab that whole thing and move it around, you're allowed to do that. That's sufficient to do the quantum computation, as long as you can move it without dropping any. So that, from an engineering standpoint, that might have some advantages. I'd like to call that blobological quantum computation. So how about moving around quasiparticles in complicated ways? Well, this is something that no one's ever done, but it's not something that's out of the question either. There's an experiment I'm very fond of, I was talking about a couple of years ago, which is sort of a first step to being able to manipulate single quasiparticles at a time, and it's to actually do quasiparticle pumping. So you have some sort of configuration like this with a bunch of gates, and sort of look down here, the sequence of pumping quasiparticles around. You have a little antidot in the middle, the antidot gets moved over to one side, it gets sucks some quasi-particles off the edge, gets isolated in the middle, moved to the other side, and emits them on the other side. And in this way, you can move quasi-particles, presumably one at a time, from one edge to the other. And you have three gates, and one at the left, one at the right, and one in the middle. Yeah. And so there's some amount of quasi-particles trapped in here, maybe zero, maybe one, maybe two. Okay. And I'm going to push from the left-hand side, I'm going to push the edge over until it touches here. Then I'm going to charge up this gate so that the antidot in the middle is bigger. Then uncharge the gate so it's isolated. Push over the other gate to bring over the other edge, and then uncharge the central gate to push off the quasiparticles. So you can sort of pump one at a time quasiparticles across the system. And this is the kind of thing that you're obviously going to have to do.
But if you're, quantum hole, then you just pump, right? The quasiparticle just have a charge deficit there, so there's no special property.
Well, the property here is that the dark region is insulating quantum Hall fluid. I mean, you can do this if you think of the dark region as being vacuum and the light region as now being electrons. This is just your standard, electron pump. What's different here is that we've inverted it such that the dark region is quantum Hall fluid and the light region is vacuum, if you want, and that allows you to pump single quasiparticles at a time, fractions of an electron. So, reading out. Another tricky issue. So one state, when two quasiparticles are moved close together, the degenerate states in principle should split. And the details of splitting depend on the state of the qubit. Not that we know exactly how the splitting is going to happen for all of them, but for the Pfaffian with Majoranas, you can probably sit down and calculate it. So, for example, you have a bunch of, some qubits for the Pfaffian. Again, the Pfaffian can't quantum compute, but okay. And take these two guys and move them together, and the energy that was degenerate is going to, maybe the spin up will increase in energy and the spin down will, quote, decrease. I have that in quotes because, of course, they're charged, so the energy is certainly going to go up, but one of them will go up more than the other. So in principle, you could think about measuring that, or measuring a force between, yes? Yeah. So someone actually looked at these? The splitting? I don't think it's been done. I don't think there's any impediment to doing it. But it's not that I know of. You can probably solve exactly the problem of two p-wave quasiparticles and... two might be enough, actually. Because... you need four, but that's four, and there's this funny minus one. It's two. The degeneracy is 2^(n/2 - 1). The minus one comes from an even odd effect of the number of electrons in the system. If you throw that away and you don't fix the number of electrons in the system, you can get by with just two. So, there's going to still be two degenerate states for two quasiparticles. It's just they'll have a different number of electrons in the system. Oh, yeah. Yeah, maybe, okay. Yeah, four. Yeah, so this is one additional. You need four. Yeah, okay, fine. Okay, so it's something that you probably can't do analytically. So, yeah. So in principle, you can measure the force between the quasiparticles, and the force between two in a spin-up and a spin-down would be different. This is, in practice, almost inconceivably difficult. Another, mutual annihilation. Only groups of particles with the same quantum numbers as the vacuum can annihilate.
It's a fundamental difficulty in quantum computation. Once you do a measurement, you change the state. Now, are you saying that for these kind of qubits, that after you perform the measurement, you do not change the state? Is that
no, you'll change the state. You'll project it onto the basis.
Where do I project anything?
It'll be, once you measure this, it will have to collapse into either spin up or spin down if you measure it in this basis.
So it has the same difficulty as...
Yeah. No, you're not, you're not beating Heisenberg or Schrodinger.
Or wave function collapse.
Wave function collapse. It's Born or whoever it was who was talking about, yeah. So, mutual, was it Max Born who first talked about wave function collapse, or someone, I don't know. Bohr. Mutual annihilation. Only groups of particles with the same quantum numbers as a quasi-particle vacuum can annihilate. So you can try doing the inverse of the initialization problem. Try to annihilate a quasi-particle, quasi-hole there, or try to do an inverse Laughlin flux insertion. A failed attempt to annihilate will leave a neutral bound state, and that can't annihilate will still be an excitation sitting there. The charge density distribution excitation spectrum will be different from the quasi-particle vacuum. So this, again, is very, very hard in practice to see what's left over there. But maybe, I don't know, it seems maybe less difficult.
Because it's not charged. It doesn't carry...
Yeah, it's uncharged. But
it carries some quantum number.
It carries a quantum number, but it's a quantum number. But it has, it would have a different charge distribution. I mean, the charge would be messed up in some way. And yeah, so it's something, you know, it's overall neutral, though. So, okay. So in measuring experiment three, interference experiments, Mach-Zehnder type things. So the kind of thing you would imagine is just an illustration. Here's your output qubit, and you take a test quasiparticle and shoot it around both directions and look at the interference pattern. Now, there's a horrible complication, which is that, you know, if you want to get any signal out of your meter, you need to use more than one test quasiparticle. But the test quasiparticle braiding around the qubit, since everything's not abelian, the test quasiparticle changes the state. So the next test quasiparticle can give you a different result.
Why do you need more than one? I didn't get that.
Well, you probably can't measure just one quasiparticle.
Oh, so that's an engineering problem in
England. It might be worse than an engineering problem.
It's very conceptual. I'm just engineering.
Yeah, these things are awfully small. You know, it's hard. Yeah, it's hard to get the exactly. It's something in principle could be measured even with one quasiparticle at a time. But I think it's something that you would. I think what you really want to do is you would like to exploit the exception to this rule. The exception to this rule is, again, if the qubit is left in a state whose quantum numbers is the same as the quasiparticle vacuum, then you can actually, in this case, if the qubit has the same quantum numbers as the quasiparticle vacuum, you can send test particle after test particle after test particle and not change the state of the system and get an interference pattern and see it. So the proposal is that one of the output states should have the qubit in the vacuum state, so it doesn't change its state as the test particle goes around it. It's just so clear and robust interference pattern. Then the question is, what do you see if it's in the other state? Well, whatever the other thing is, it will be different. So one, you know, maybe your spin up will be a very clear interference pattern, and your spin down will be like some mess or something. So I'm not sure. This is sort of an open question. How do you do these interference experiments? So it really depends. You know, it's kind of interesting. Rats. There we go. If I back up a second. You know, there's actually complications associated with, you know, how is this test particle entangled with the next quasi particle and so forth and so on. And you'd really like to avoid those issues in doing your measurement if you can.
But how do you actually shoot it around? I mean,
let me come to that. So you could imagine having some sort of racetrack, you know, a little potential. Yeah. I mean, that's the Gedanken way to do it. But this is the good question. This is Moti Heibloom's Mach-Zehnder interferometer, which he's using edge states in this case. And it's basically just a beam splitter and two mirrors and then two detectors. And you can sort of see how this works here. There's, you know, the dark region is quantum Hall fluid and the light region is vacuum. And you go along this edge, you hit this quantum point contact, which acts as a beam splitter. You split around this way, or around this way, and you come back and you re-interfere, and you either go out this way or you go out this way. And he's done this. Actually, this is really nice. There is really nice quantum Hall, integer quantum Hall interference.
What did you see?
I don't have the data here, but you can look up the article. It was in Nature last year. He modulates it by pulling out the length of this path. But he can also do it with magnetic field and so forth. It's a very pretty experiment. He has not done it for the fractional state, and that actually makes me worry. If he can't do it for your standard fractional state, life is going to get a little bit difficult.
Why are you worried about it?
He hasn't. Well, he just says it's been more difficult. He hasn't been able to do it.
Steve needs it to be done at 1 millikelvin.
Yeah. You know, that doesn't. 1 millikelvin doesn't bother me. We'll come to that. One thing to keep track of is you can't, because this region here has been blocked off by quantum point contact, you can't put an arbitrary number of quantum particles, quasi-particles in here. Leon mentioned that a couple days ago. However, you can put an arbitrary number of quasi-particles in here, so presumably this would be your test region. So.
Wait, sorry, so this geometry doesn't work for the fractional Hall effect?
Well, no, it does, it should work, but the problem is that you have to make sure that you're inserting quasi-particles in the right place here, because you can't insert them here. Uh-huh. You have to insert them here. So hopefully it will work. Anyway, I'm hopeful that Modi will be able to show this working for fractional quantum Hall effect, and then we'll have sort of the next step. How am I doing? Oh, I'm way over time, aren't I? So I'm up to decoherence. Okay, process number one, stray braids. An additional braid that occurs that you didn't intend. So, for example, you're holding onto your quasi-particles with like quantum, you know, with little STM tips, and one of them jumps off, braids around another, and comes back, and you didn't realize it did that. You can make that arbitrarily small by keeping the quasi-particles far apart. This is one of the reasons people are so excited about this, because this process is so unfavored. Decoherence two, local perturbations, things like phonons, photons, and so forth. They don't directly decohere the system, because since these degrees of freedom are so spread out and delocal, you can't go in with a photon and just kick one. But unfortunately, they can make unwanted quasi-particle, quasi-hole pairs. And these things can cause you problems. If this quasi-particle, quasi-hole pair comes in and you create it and then it re-annihilates without wrapping around any other quasi-particle, there's no problem. It doesn't cause any trouble. However, if you split them completely apart and they go wandering off on their own, I mean, actually, there is some gap for these guys becoming completely free and wandering off on their own, and these are deadly. They'll also kill the quantum Hall effect, but in fact, we're more sensitive than the usual quantum Hall effect because, you know, these quasi-particles don't have to go all the way across the system to kill us. They just have to wrap around one quasi-particle, and then we're dead. So,
I think we need a factor of 100 increase in the gaps.
Well, or a factor of 100 decrease in temperature. So okay. We need to keep the system much, much colder than the quasi-particle, quasi-hole gap. The more we gap, it's about 100 millikelvin. It varies sample to sample, but more or less, that's the right number. The parafermionic state is much less than that, maybe 20 millikelvin or something like that.
Steve, remind me, has anybody seen an actual plateau for any of these
12/5, yes. Yeah, I showed you 12/5
earlier. No, there was a minimum.
There's a plateau. But this number is not actually, these numbers are not so hard. There's a couple groups around the world gearing up to do nuclear DMAG stages and quantum Hall effect. There, you know, the Florida group, there's the Utah group, there's one at Bell, there's Jim Eisenstein is doing a Pomeranchuk cell. All of these should be able to get you down to the 1 millikelvin region or below. So these things are maybe not the most serious impediment. You build a good fridge, you'll get there. Actually, there's another issue, which is that you can make your fridge go down to 1 millikelvin or even 50 microkelvin with some of these tricks. But actually getting the electrons that cold is a real issue. You have to filter everything like crazy. But a lot of these are smart experimentalists, and they're not afraid of it. So, OK. Decoherence three, this is what Duncan was talking about. A slight non-degeneracy of the Hilbert space. For any finite distance between the quasi-particles, there's some tunneling or mixing between the states, hence splitting between the states and the degenerate space. This, of course, ruins everything. You can think of this for the more read state as hopping of the Majoranas. The Majorana that's here moves to there, and you get some sort of splitting. So how small is the tunneling as a function of the distance? Hopefully, this thing is exponentially small. If it's not, you're really screwed. For the more read, there's pretty good arguments why it should be exponentially small. For the others, I don't know of a good argument except that, what else can it be? Right, yeah. That's what else it could be.
That's good enough.
Yeah, in this case, non-abelian statistics become an approximation valid only time scales short compared to this tunneling. Okay, well, if the tunneling is extremely small, you can do the computation in a limited time, then maybe you're okay. So one thing, you need to keep the quasi-particles far enough apart. And the thing that's really bothersome is you have to keep the quasi-particles far apart, even from stray trapped quasi-particles. When you think about quantum Hall effect, you know, it's not a pure state with just quantum Hall fluid. There are lots of little quasi-particles trapped in wells. If one of your particles comes close to that, it will mix with it, and everything gets all screwed up. So you need to keep the quasi-particles far away from even trapped other trapped quasi-particles. And this is going to be, this is probably going to be the killer. This is something that I don't know if is going to be something that's conquerable or not. But with that said, it's not even that well known what the disorder is or how many stray trapped quasi-particles there are in a lot of these systems. So that makes me think to the, go and wish that, you know, the rotating Bose gases that won't have this problem of stray trapped quasi-particles because there's essentially no disorder are going to be the solution. So since I've gone over an hour, and I think I was going to then go back to do the numerical experiments, but I think maybe I should end there. Anyone who wants to hear about how you do Monte Carlo to figure out exactly what the braid operations are with when you drag one quasi-particle around the other can talk to me. So let me just skip ahead to the, let's see, I forget if I have a summary or not, but.
The Edward Zion movie?
Oh no, I don't have the Edward Zion movie, but I should have shown you the Edward Zion movie. But I just thank my collaborators again and a bunch of other people who I've talked to a lot about these topics.
Issue here is that, well, the quantum computer is not going to be built, we all know that. Usually, is this
have you told your funders that?
No, so the question is going to be even more or less built than other other proposed hardware.
Actually,
it seems to be not.
You know,
it seems to be, this is perfect, you know.
No, actually, you know.
Your age is showing.
Yeah, it seems to be.
Let me tell you something.
Are you honest,
you know, the people who are way ahead in this quantum computation game are the ion trapping people, and they're smart guys. You know, these atomic physicists are smart guys, and they really know their stuff. And Jeff Kimball, among the atomic physicists, is Jeff Kimball. He's a trap person. He states that he believes that topological quantum computation is the only way that's ever going to work. So at least among the people who have the best lead right now, there's a feeling that this has something to add to the story.
The reason is you don't have to worry about evaporation, which is the really the killer in all that.
You know, but you have other problems. You know, it's the.
I mean, I think the challenge really, is on the hardware is to be able to get non-abelian topological states without breaking down those invariants in spin systems or in electron systems. The principle is nothing forbidding that.
But why do I care if I break time reversal? I mean, I can break time reversal.
Nothing's wrong with it, but the energy scales are tiny.
Slightly different. So the issue here is finding the right system, right Hamiltonian. I mean, that's the issue.
Well, you could find a system in which the gap was 1,000 degrees Kelvin, and you're in a level SU2 level 3 state.
Yeah. If you could do such a thing, obviously that would be much preferable. Yeah.
I think that's
speed time reversal is not the issue.
No.
You could imagine some ferromagnetic system, which is very strong.
I'm just saying
that energy scale. Yeah.
We don't need to rely on putting on just the quantum Hall systems only. That's what we have now.
That's the only reason why we're talking about that exists.
At least we believe. You know, the more read state is the only one of these things. Well, okay, maybe there's some of these funny compounds that break, superconductors that break time reversal might also have some of these. Does anyone know of a chiral P wave superconductor? I mean, that has similar properties.
Yeah, so this is actually a very good problem for theoretical physicists. Think of the right system which could have this ground state. I mean, all the engineering problems that you were alluding to, in principle, can disappear if we find the right system. I'm very excited about this.
You know, you can ask how well physicists have done in, you might have said, to ask a theorist to think of a system that will have superconductivity at 400 Kelvin.
We didn't do so well at that
either. I mean, it's possible that such states, such systems exist, and we just have to cook up the right spin system with the right symmetries or something, and we'll find it. But it's also possible that they're pretty elusive.
I mean, I mean, that would be pretty elusive. It'd be very hard to convince any experimentalist, because I have tried asking them to manipulate quasi particles in quantum processes.
Yeah. No, actually,
that sounds crazy.
You know, Charlie Marcus really, I mean, this one quantum Hall pump, Charlie Marcus is actually, I mean, he sort of, when I talked to him about it, in like, you know, 5 years ago, and he said, yeah, it sounds like a great experiment, I'm going to do it. And of course, I think it basically looked like it was too hard. But I think he's giving it another shot, because he didn't lay pen to paper on it. But I know that he's really serious, because he's asked Lauren for samples to do it in. So at least he's getting a sample. That means he's probably devoted a student to it. So at least, you know, the idea of manipulating quasi-particles is not something that is so beyond conception that you have to throw it out altogether.
In terms of the measurement, so you saw a bunch of experiments that would be pretty much non-demolition, and you keep the system in track, but in principle you could also tune the magnetic field to a slightly higher value that will take you out of the state altogether and measure degeneracy broken states, right?
Yeah, so the question is, can you gain, I mean, in the Bose condensates, many measurements are done by turning off the trap or turning off the whatever, you know, which is something you can do. I don't think that's going to be very productive in the quantum Hall case, but, you know, maybe someone can prove me wrong. I suspect that, you know, the damage you do to a state by changing the magnetic field, you know, all these quasi-particles run in simultaneously to try to, you know, because the magnetic field is now different, the Fermi fraction is now different, it's going to screw up everything. But maybe maybe if you change the magnetic field and simultaneously change the gate voltage to change the, you know, in such a way such that the number of quasi-particle stays fixed, there might be something you can gain from it. I don't know, though.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, Steve, let's see the numerical results now.
You really want to see it?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, those who want to leave can. But
okay.
This room is available, so.
Thank you so much.
Okay. Sure. Well, thank you. Yeah. Okay. So let me back up.
I mean, you have them, right? I mean,
oh, yeah.
I really like to see them, if it's not a problem.
Okay. Okay.
Well, being realistic, I just visited Microsoft Research and spoke with Mike Friedman. And he said, well, you know, there's this new theory, which is four-dimensional topological field theory, which is much better for us because real materials are three-dimensional.
Shooting Zan's quantum Hall.
No, I mean, I don't know. It's some I don't know. Some theory of knots again. Four dimensional topological field theory is much better because the real materials are three dimensional.
Freeman's a smart guy. Yeah. You know, he's you know, maybe he's doing that just for fun, but it may be that he's actually.
He wants to build a quantum computer. I mean, really wants to build a quantum computer.
All right. So the missing link. So the question is, what happens when you break quasi-particles around each other? Should I go through? Yeah, let me go through this. So what we'd like to do is theoretically drag quasi-particles around each other and find out what the accumulated Berry's phase is. This is the expression for Berry's phase in terms of the wave function with the quasi-particles at a bunch of positions. So if you know where the quasi-particles are, what their positions are as a function of time, you just integrate this up and you get the phase. Where does Berry's phase come from? Anyone need this? It's a correction to, okay, let me skip this. Bum, 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 solve time-dependent, solution of time-dependent Schrodinger equation. There you go, you get Berry's phase. And that's what we'd like to do. We'd like to integrate this thing up. In quantum Hall effect, of course, you have nice expressions for these wave functions with the quasi-particles as a function of position. For the quantum Hall effect, you know the wave function, for example, Laughlin's. So you can calculate the Berry's phase and hence the statistics. And this is what Arva, Schrieffer, and Wilczek did in 1984, subject to a number of approximations, which actually were probably unjustified then, but in retrospect can be shown to be right. The problem is that even if you know the wave function, you still need to integrate over these innocent-looking brackets mean integrate over all the electrons in the system. And that's a hard thing to do in general. So it's maybe not so, according to Wilczek, it's a scandal that we haven't done anything like this for the Pfaffian. It's not so much a scandal we haven't done this for a Pfaffian. It's a miracle you could do this for Laughlin, even in any approximation. again, what we want to do is, let me write final wave function in terms of u times initial wave function, where u as the integral of this gauge field A, and the gauge field is just this matrix element. This is what you would do for abelian statistics. If the wave function is a vector in a degenerate space, i.e. non-abelian statistics, now you have a wave function that's a superposition, some vector, and you have a Berry's matrix, which relates the initial wave function to the final wave function, and your Berry's matrix is now a path-ordered integral of a non-abelian gauge field. So this non-abelian gauge field is inner product of the different wave functions with respect to each other and ddt sitting there. So this is, we'll check in Z, 1984, talked about Berry's matrices first. So this is the object we'd like to calculate, if we can. For the Mori-Fafian, I'll tell you in advance, this is the only one where we have results. We have a good guess of the braiding behavior, mainly both from the conformal field theory, but also from this BCS mapping, that you can map the Fafian to a BCS-paired composite fermion system. And further, we have a simple expression for the trial wave function. The Fafian is just a square root of a determinant. And that's nice, because that means you can take the wave function and evaluate it numerically in a time proportional to n cubed. So if you can evaluate a wave function numerically, you can use quantum Monte Carlo very easily. You generate these wave functions, you calculate them using calculate these inner products using quantum Monte Carlo. For the parafermion states, your life is more difficult. You know less about the braiding behavior, although there's a very detailed paper by Slingerland and Bass, people using conformal field theory and quantum groups, which does make a prediction, which actually I tend to believe, actually. We have expressions for the trial wave functions, but they're unfortunate in that they have this anti-symmetrizing operator out front. So the wave functions always look like some function of your variables anti-symmetrized over the position of all of your electrons. Now that's a real problem, because whenever you see this anti-symmetrizer, it means it takes a time of n factorial to calculate the wave function. So that makes us unhappy. But it turns out that you can calculate the gauge field, avoiding calculating the wave function itself. There's a trick to do that, which I won't go into in detail. The truth is we haven't been able to make it work, and I'm starting to worry that there's a fundamental problem with it. So
the idea is that the product of two wave functions is symmetric instead of anti-symmetric?
It has some symmetries associated with it, which you can exploit. It's not fully symmetric, but it has some symmetries that you exploit, and it kills the factorial, and so you can do it in polynomial time. But
this is ongoing research.
This is ongoing research. This guy, Ilya Finkler, who's actually a very bright grad student, has been working on it for almost a year. Actually, right now he's studying for his oral exam. So,
but you haven't given up.
But we have not given up. We're still optimistic that it's going to work. But it has some subtlety that we don't understand yet. So this is the actual type of numerical experiments we're doing. This was with Yaroslav Cherkovniak. We consider the Fafian state. We also looked at the Laughlin states just to make sure we knew what we were doing. Actually, I thought, never mind. I'll come back to that. So we used up to 64 electrons, up to 6 quasi-holes. Calculations are done on a sphere. More electrons means, of course, you have a bigger sphere because the density is fixed. Magnetic monopoles in the middle of the sphere. Quasi-holes are on the surface of the sphere. The quasi-holes I've drawn as pancakes here because they're rather large objects. They have a finite extent. And we'd like to take the quasi-holes around each other and find out what happens. Notice the finite extent of these quasi-holes means that the sphere has to be big enough such that you take the quasi-particles cleanly around each other without bumping them into each other. So we're just going to use quantum Monte Carlo to find out what happens to the wave function. So here's the Fafian with two quasi-holes. We'll take one quasi-hole here, take the other around the equator. And for the Laughlin state, you do indeed get a phase of pi over 3, confirming the old prediction. At the time, I thought we were the first people to actually do this with Monte Carlo. But someone actually beat us by about a year. I didn't discover that till later.
This is within some numerical precision?
Yeah, it's within some numerical precision, which you can make as small as you want just by beating it to death. So,
what is the exact numerical operational statement for taking the quasi-hole around each other? What do you actually do?
So you have the wave function.
You track the wave function?
Yeah. So, yeah, there are these parameters in the wave function, and you change them.
Yeah.
And you need to discretize and do it on a grid.
Just
and
use your power.
Yeah, exactly. So going forward again. Dun, 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 dun. Yeah, you have to discretize. And in fact, there's a number of tricks that we have discovered since writing the paper about a year ago that enable us to do larger systems that we haven't implemented yet because, you know, we're really interested in doing the power fermion system at this point. For the Pfaffian, actually for two quasi-holes, you have a non-degenerate ground state, as Duncan points out. The conformal field theory calculation tells you that the phase you should get should be zero. They should be relative bosons. And in fact, so here's the, for different sides of the system, the black curve is the largest system. This is the latitude distance here. So the angles you believe are the ones which are nearest to the top and nearest to the bottom. The phase is a small fraction of pi, and it does indeed seem to be converging to zero for far apart. And you have to go to reasonably large systems to get it to converge down to zero because the quasi-particles are pretty big objects. So black is the largest system. For four quasi-holes, you put four around the equator, and we're going to switch two. And there are four such exchanges. And we're going to pick, there's a two-dimensional degenerate subspace, and we're going to pick an easy basis such that in the particular basis, the predicted unitary rotations are given in simple forms like this. We'll measure the unitary matrix we get. It will parameterize it in terms of a bunch of parameters. This is an arbitrary unitary matrix, and we'll just measure these parameters. This is the prediction of the conformal field theory, and this is the result. So what do you actually expect? So this region here is where the quasi-holes stay farthest apart. This angle here is the opening angle along the bottom, the opening angle between these two quasi-holes. We can open them up as far or as narrow as we want. And this region is where they sort of stay farthest away from the other quasi-particles in the system. Out here, they start touching the other ones, and out here, they start touching each other. And indeed, the triangles is the largest system. I believe that's a 64-electron system. And indeed, the parameter eta becomes 0.25, more or less like what you want, and beta is pretty close to zero. So, you know, within the accuracy of what we're doing, it pretty much agrees with what we expect. We can probably do larger systems at this point. We haven't done it yet. So at least agrees reasonably well. So that ends the discussion on numerical experiments.
This poster is very nice.
Yeah, it's posted.
And how intensive is this?
It's not so bad. I mean,
64 is not so bad.
No, we did most of this on a workstation. I think in the end, Yaroslav ended up stealing time on a supercomputer, but just because it was more convenient, we could have done them all on a workstation. It's not that.
So the true parafermion state, what is stopping you is not computer at all. It's just figuring out how to get rid of the factorial in an operational way, which will allow you to get the.
Yeah, well, it may end up being a combination of both in the end. But yeah, I mean, the first thing that was stopping us is a factorial, and we're pretty sure that we have a way to defeat the factorial, but as of yet, you know, I can't say we're right because.
And remind me, there is no theoretical work on what the.
There is theoretical work by Slingeland and Bass.
Okay.
And it's.
I don't even know the names. Are they mathematicians?
They're mathematicians. I think Billy Slingerland is now a postdoc at Microsoft, if I'm not mistaken. Bass is it's quantum groups guy, and he seems to know his stuff pretty well. I would not guarantee. It seems the structure of what he's come up with seems to be right, but it's if he got something wrong, it's likely that what's wrong is actually the abelian part, which is maybe least interesting. The non-abelian part, it's very, you know, you sit down and say, okay, give me a set of matrices that obey, you know, with the right dimension, that obey the right, you know, braid operations, you know, our representation of the braid group. It's actually kind of hard to come up with one. And, you know, he comes up with one that has all the right properties. But of course, you can multiply it by any abelian representation out front. And so it's possible that that part of it's wrong. But it seems to me that it seems to be right.
So
yeah.
Where can I find that?
It's on the web. It is.
On my notes?
Oh. Maybe it's on HEP theory instead. Yeah.
It could be on Comp. Yeah,
It was cross-listed on Comp. Yeah. A Slingerland and Bass. Bass is the guy. B-A-I-S. B-A-I-S. Yeah. Yeah, he's Dutch.
Very nice. I mean, we'll have many talks on non-abelian quantum computation. And I think you started it off extremely well.
Oh, good. I'm glad.
Pedagogical.
What about how much numerical work done on the in the BCS analogy?
No, very little actually. I don't think any. It's which is, I mean, it seems like the thing is, you know, the BCS analogy, everything's composite fermionized anyway. So what's kind of, you can ask, what's the point of doing a detailed numerical study when you then have to composite fermionize and everything goes to hell, you know?
In the P-wave
superconductor, yeah, exactly. You know, if you were studying an actual P-wave superconductor, you'd feel like, you know, it would be worth doing the detailed. Steve Simon, nice to meet you. If you were studying an actual P-wave superconductor, you might feel like it was worth doing the detailed numerical work. But since you know you're going to have to composite fermionize in the end anyway, it's kind of, you know, you feel like it might not be worth beating it to death.
I meant mainly for the issues of the splitting of the states.
Yeah. No, I don't think any has been done. I think it's all been sort of back in the envelope arguments.
It's kind of, that's the one issue that's not properly treated, and it wasn't treated when I asked about it a few years.
Yeah, no, I think that's correct. It hasn't been. I mean, everything is sort of hand-waving arguments about, you know, the overlap between the bound states. You know, the bound Majorana states are going to be exponentially bound. And so if you get them far enough apart, there's going to be very little overlap.